This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents No Fool Like an Old Fool by Robert Asprin and Peter J. Heck, narrated by Noah Michael Levine. Prologue. General Blitzkrieg was just lining up a tricky 4-meter putt when a buzzer sounded on his desk. He flinched at the noise, and the ball jerked to the right, missing the target by a good 0.5 meter.
"Damn it all to hell! What is it now?"
he snarled, stopping over to the desk and pressing a button.
"Colonel Battleaxe to see you, sir," came the voice of Major Sparrowhawk, his adjutant. "Shall I send her in?"
Blitzkrieg stifled another curse and nodded. Then, realizing that Sparrowhawk couldn't hear him, he said,
"Sure, sure, send her in."
He quickly stashed his custom-made ultra-carbon putter behind the desk and turned to stare out the window behind him. The view of the North Ransom Mountains behind the old city wasn't anything to get ecstatic over, but he was pleased at the thought of having his back turned to Battleaxe when she entered the office. A subtle slight, but nothing she could take overt offense at. If he'd been able to contrive a way to make her cool her heels in the outer office for 15 or 20 minutes, he'd have enjoyed it even more. But that would have required some advanced planning. Might as well just get the unpleasant confrontation over with. He didn't know what the colonel was here for, but it was bound to be unpleasant. He heard the door slide open, but he resisted the impulse to turn. Let the old harpy wait until he was good and ready. He let a thin smile cross his face as he heard the colonel come into the office.
"I think you've forgotten something, General,"
came a voice from behind him. Blitzkrieg turned just in time to see Colonel Battleaxe toss him the golf ball he'd left sitting in the middle of his office floor. Caught off guard, he snatched at it clumsily and stifled another curse as it bounced off his chest, then ricocheted off his toe to roll under the desk. He determinedly ignored it.
"What brings you here today, Colonel?"
he asked, doing his best not to show his annoyance at her.
"I've got the latest intelligence reports on the Zenobian situation," she said. "You'll be glad to know—"
"I won't be glad unless you're going to tell me those blasted overgrown lizards have eaten Captain Jester,"
said the General, losing his composure after all.
"That's the planet he's on, and the less I hear about it, the less I'll have to ruin my appetite."
"I doubt there's much that could do that," said Battleaxe, eyeing his ample midsection. "Anyhow, you need to know this, whether you like it or not. The second race that Jester found on Zenobia, the Nanoids, claimed to be indigenous to the planet."
"Very interesting, I'm sure," said Blitzkrieg.
He poked his toe under the desk experimentally, hoping he could kick out the golf ball without bending over to look for it. No such luck.
"More interesting than you may realize, General," said Battleaxe smugly. "We have 2 technologically advanced races inhabiting 1 planet, and both are apparently legitimately native to that world. Now, as you may recall, Captain Jester's company was called there because the Zenobians had detected the Nanoids conducting surveillance of their major cities. This suggests that the Nanoids may be looking to expand their territory, and you can surely guess what that would lead to."
"Civil war," said Blitzkrieg, waving a hand dismissively. "Not our problem, as long as the conflict doesn't break out into Alliance space. We keep a strict, hands-off policy and provide Siphonotarian aid where appropriate. They cover that in second-year Milsai at the Academy. Or did you miss that lecture?"
"No, General,"
said Battleaxe, smiling. "Did you miss the fact that the Zenobians signed a mutual defense treaty with the Alliance just over a year ago, and that we're now making diplomatic overtures to the Nanoids to get a treaty with them? That planet already is Alliance space, and if we're not careful, we're going to be deeply entangled with both sides in the conflict. And the only combat-ready Alliance military unit in the entire system is 1 Legion Company." Blitzkrieg's eyes lit up.
"Yes," he hissed.
"No,"
said Battleaxe, shaking her head.
"We can't just leave them in the line of fire."
"Of course we can. It's the Legion way,"
said Blitzkrieg, a feral grin on his face.
"Maybe I did miss a lecture at the Academy after all,"
said Battleaxe coldly.
"Or is that one of the lessons reserved for the old boy network?"
"Nothing more than learning to look at the big picture," said Blitzkrieg.
A superior smirk came to his face.
"If you're ever going to get stars on your shoulders, that's the kind of choice you have to be ready to make. Colonel, they don't play this game in short pants, you know."
"I'll take your word for that," said Battleaxe.
She leaned forward and picked up the golf ball, which had rolled out of the far side of the desk and come to rest at her feet. She handed it to the General and said,
"But if Fool's Company is going to be in the middle of a civil war, I'm going to make sure they know in advance just what kind of game they're in, and what kind of pants their superior officers are wearing. In your case—"
She paused and looked Blitzkrieg up and down.
"No, It's too easy. I won't say it.
She saluted, then turned and walked out of the office with a mischievous grin. Blitzkrieg spent the rest of the day trying to figure out just what she'd meant by it.
Chapter 1 Journal Number 633
After his success in the Zenobian affair, my employer had naturally assumed that his Legion career was back on track. He had scored not only a diplomatic but a scientific coup in discovering a new alien race, the Nanoids. He had managed to discredit the new commander sent by headquarters to take over his unit, and he had successfully cemented trade relations with our hosts, the Zenobians. Little did he realize that there were machinations underway in several distant worlds, all of which were destined to intrude on his peace of mind.
The yellowing poster in the dirty store window hung crookedly between two nondescript advertising signs, and its once bright colors had long since faded into shades of off-white. But Zigger found it beautiful nonetheless. He had been admiring its picture of a heroic figure in a black jumpsuit ever since his father had brought him down this street and he had seen the store. To a small lepoid from a second-rate factory town on the planet Talun, it was the stuff of his dreams. He hadn't been able to read the words the first time he saw it, but he'd gotten his father to read them to him. Join the Space Legion and see the galaxy. Zigger hadn't known what a galaxy was back then, but he knew magic when he saw it. It made his nose twitch and his ears snap to attention, and as far as he was concerned, whatever the poster was selling had to be the real thing. And every time he came down that street, even when he was running errands for his mom or late for school, he'd stop for a brief moment in front of the store and gaze upon the poster with loving eyes. It was something of a letdown when Zigger realized what kind of merchandise the store sold. The store, its name was Spotty's, sold nothing at all heroic or magical, just stupid ordinary things like furry store, Groot repellent, stupid entertainment capsules, and a selection of print zines. The Space Legion recruiter had come by one day and put the poster in the window, one of many crowded into the space. Several years later, it was still there. But not even that could detract from the allure. Zigger had already made up his mind that he was going to join the Space Legion, and everything else was second to that. His parents didn't necessarily approve, but they were smart enough to use it to motivate him to do well in school. "You'll never get into the Space Legion if you don't do your math problems," his father would say. And that was all Zigger needed to dig in for another round of attrition and subduction. Or if he didn't like something his mother had made for supper, she would say, "Eat up, little one. You have to be a big, strong, healthy lepoid to join the Space Legion." And Zigger would gobble down the last few pieces of brittle root on his plate. It worked every time, and even after Zigger figured out what his mom was doing, he didn't stop listening. After all, it stood to reason that she was probably right. And so, young Zigger grew up strong and smart. And all his teachers said he could be anything he wanted to when he grew up. That pleased Zigger, but all he really cared about in life was joining the Space Legion when he grew up. So, when he hopped onto the stage to receive his school diploma, with honors in three subjects, though not the highest honors, those went to Snickley, who was a grind and a suck-up anyway, and citations as an all-Talun athlete in three different sports, and a plaque for good citizenship, everyone expected great things of him. The commencement speaker had told the young lepoids that the universe was their tuber, and even though the graduates knew it was a cliché, most of them were willing to believe it for a moment at least. So it came as a considerable shock to Zigger when his parents put their feet firmly down in opposition to his announcement that he was going to join the Space Legion instead of going on to Hervard University, where his grades, not to mention his prowess at running and jumping, were certain to earn him a scholarship.
"You can't just throw away an opportunity like this," said his father, glowering at him from the head of the breakfast table. "With a Hervard education, you can do anything you want to." "But I can do what I want to without it," said Zigger, with a fork full of sin veggies halfway to his mouth. "Besides, if I'm good enough to get in now, I'll still be good enough after I've served a term in the Legion. And they let you save up your pay to cover college expenses. It's a really smelliferous deal, Dad."
"Smells pretty bad to me," muttered Zigger's dad.
"Now, Oswald, you know that's just the slang these youngsters use nowadays," said Zigger's mother in a conciliatory tone. "When he says smelliferous, he just means it's very chiroptious."
"Well, why doesn't he say so then?" said Oswald.
"Have to get a dictionary to figure out what kids mean these days."
"What I mean is that I'm not going to Hervard," said Zigger. "Not until I find out if I can make it in the Legion. It's the only thing I've always wanted. You know that, Dad."
Oswald shook his head, started to say something, then took a deep breath.
"You know what? I think I'm going to let you do it."
"Yay!"
cheered Zigger, hopping out of his seat and prancing around the table.
"With a couple of conditions," his father continued. "First, if you get accepted to Hervard, and if they agree to hold a place for you while you complete one tour of duty in the Legion. If you still want to stay in the Legion after that, I guess there's not much I can do for you."
"I accept those conditions, Dad," said Zigger,
pausing in a celebratory dance.
"They don't matter anyhow. All I've ever wanted is to join the Legion."
"There's an old saying," said Zigger's mother. "Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. I hope the Legion is everything you want it to be, and if not, there's always Hervard."
But Zigger wasn't listening anymore.
"Sergeant Brandy, may I ask a question?"
It took all of Brandy's self-control not to permit herself a deep sigh.
"What is it, Mahatma?"
she asked. She knew, even before she heard the question, that it was going to take all her resources to come up with an answer. Mahatma could twist almost anything she said into a refutation of all the discipline and authority the Legion depended on, but that was just part of a day's work for the top sergeant of Omega Company.
"We have been on Zenobia nearly 6 months,"
said the young legionnaire, smiling beatifically. It was his invariable expression. If she hadn't known better, Brandy would have assumed Mahatma was on some kind of meds, legal or otherwise. In this outfit, it was most likely otherwise. Brandy waited for Mahatma. He hadn't asked any question yet, so she knew he wasn't done. The silence lingered. Finally, as the rest of the training squad fidgeted, she said, as calmly as she could manage,
"That's right, Mahatma. We've been here 6 months."
Sometimes she thought half that time had been spent with her answering Mahatma's questions, but she carried on with only a hint of impatience.
"Now, what was your question?"
Mahatma's smile never wavered.
"When we had finished our job on Landor, we were sent to this planet. You told us it was because we had done a good job there."
He paused again.
"That's right,"
said Brandy, not letting the pause stretch out this time.
"What did you—"
"We have not done a good job here,"
Mahatma broke in.
"Or have we not finished the job we came to do?"
"Neither one,"
said Brandy.
"We came as military advisors to the Zenobians, and we've been able to solve their problems without any fighting at all. That's doing a damn good job, if you want my opinion."
"But we have not been sent to another posting," argued Mahatma. "That must mean the brass don't think we finished the job."
"Dude's making sense,"
came a voice from the back of the squad before Brandy could answer. She was pretty sure she knew who it was, but she thought she'd be better off dealing directly with Mahatma instead of being drawn off into side issues. At least, unless she needed to divert everyone's attention from whatever point Mahatma was leading up to. The little legionnaire always had a point, usually one that undermined some basic tenet of military doctrine. She still hadn't figured out what he was doing in the military. Luckily for Brandy, most of his points were too subtle for anyone but her and Mahatma to understand, and she wasn't sure she always understood them.
"The job isn't over," Brandy conceded, "but that doesn't mean we haven't done well. In fact, if we'd messed up the job, we'd damn well know it by now."
Sarge.
Another of the training squad had a hand up. Brandy frowned. She'd hoped the answer she'd given would end the digression and let her get back to the training session.
"Yes, Slayer, what is it?"
If we were doing so well, why did headquarters send that Major Botchop to take over the company?"
"Headquarters doesn't usually know squat about conditions in the field," said Brandy. "You all saw how out of touch the Major was when he finally got here. Things didn't get straightened out until the Captain came back from his trip to the Zenobian capital, and you noticed they haven't tried replacing the Major. In fact, rumor has it, the Captain's in for a promotion. If that doesn't mean we're doing things right, I don't know what does."
"Hey, yeah, that makes sense,"
said Slayer. The rest of the squad murmured its agreement, and Brandy relaxed. Now she had a chance to regain control of the exercise, if only Mahatma didn't start up again.
"All right, people," she said. "Today we're going to talk about desert survival techniques. What's the first thing you need if you get stranded away from the camp?"
"Weapons," said one voice.
"Nah, you need shelter," said another.
"A map,"
said a third.
"That's all good stuff to have," said Brandy, "but none of it's going to do you much good without a supply of safe drinking water. I'm going to show you some ways to find water out in the desert."
From that point, the exercise went ahead as planned. By the end of the morning session, Brandy was actually pleased with the Legionnaire's progress. Even Mahatma managed to keep from asking any more irrelevant questions. Not that she expected that to last long. If there is any port in the Alliance where private space yachts might dock without undue flurry, it is undoubtedly Lorelei, a space station that spends its every waking hour as a playground for the wealthy. So, while the unannounced appearance of a Logan 350, one of the sleekest and most distinguished vessels available to a private citizen, caused the traffic control officers on duty at Lorelei to give their undivided attention to getting docked smoothly and without delay, it caused no comment. Its electronic signature, revealing a high level of quasi-military hardware on board, might have raised a few eyebrows on other worlds and stations, but Lorelei took it in without a blink. Nor were many eyebrows raised when the yacht unloaded a vintage hover limo. Rich people often brought their own transport vehicles to Lorelei. Those paying attention might have recognized this one as an exception, a top-of-the-line Flutes Royale, which to the trained eye revealed subtle security modifications worthy of a planetary chief executive state limo. Despite its arrogantly plain exterior, this was a vehicle many billionaires might consider a bit pricey. Its performance and safety more than justified the price, but even so, few of them would have been willing to pay it. As soon as the hover limo was unloaded, a compactly built woman and a well-muscled man emerged from the Logan, escorting a lean, energetic, middle-aged man into the passenger seat. Racing fans might have recognized the woman as Maria Delia Fanatico, a Formula Ultra race driver who had mysteriously retired about 15 years ago after an impressive string of victories. The man was Eddie Grossman, whose face was familiar to veterans of the elite Red Eagles Army Unit, if not to the general public. As the unit's small arms instructor, he had built an almost uncanny reputation for never missing a shot he had called. There weren't any immediate alarm bells at the Fat Chance Casino's communications center a few moments later when the passenger appeared on their screens, calling from the comm unit in his vehicle. He asked, in a tone that made it clear he was issuing an order, not making a request, to be connected with Willard Fool. "One moment, sir. I'll have him paged," said the junior clerk who took the call. It says a certain amount for the clerk's training that he not only recognized Captain Jester's civilian name, but knew that anyone asking for the casino's majority stockholder under that name ought to be put through without delay. "Whom should I say is calling, sir?"
"Victor Fool," said the caller.
And that, at last, set off the alarms.
Yes, sir,
said the junior clerk, and it was something of a miracle that he managed to put the caller on hold without disconnecting him. This was not one of the contingencies that the clerk's training had anticipated. The clerk's face disappeared, to be replaced by an ad for the Fat Chance Casino Supper Club and Floor Show, featuring several shots of Dee Dee Watkins in revealing costumes. A few moments later, a different young man's face appeared on Victor Fool's viewscreen. He peered at the viewscreen mounted below the online camera and said enthusiastically,
"Captain Jester here. What can I do for you?"
Victor Fool peered suspiciously at the viewscreen for perhaps 3 whole seconds.
"I asked for Willard, not his screening service," he growled. "Get him on. If he's in a meeting, get him out of it. And if I have to wait much longer, there'll be a bunch of people looking for new jobs. Now let me talk to my son, you miserable imposter, or you'll be the first one on the list."
The young actor somehow managed to keep his composure.
"Please hold, sir," he said.
Before Victor Fool could get in another word, the screen returned to shots of Dee Dee's dance routine, interspersed with happy diners enjoying the 4-star cuisine. Not visible to the unsuspecting eye were various subliminals touting the casino's primary business. By this time, Fool's hover limo had floated to within eyeball range of the Fat Chance. Impatiently, the weapons magnate reached out and broke the connection.
"Incompetent idiots," he muttered. "Willard will have some explaining to do when I get him in my sights. I thought the boy had better sense."
In the front seat, the driver and bodyguard said nothing. In a few moments more, the limo had pulled in front of the casino's marquee front. Eddie Grossman hopped out almost before the vehicle had stopped moving. He scanned the various gawking onlookers and uniformed hotel flunkies with professional thoroughness before opening the door to allow Victor Fool to storm out, making a beeline for the hotel entrance. Not missing a beat, Grossman followed a half-pace behind him. At the wheel of the hover limo, Maria Delia Fanatico watched them go with a sigh. Fool rarely got this angry. She was almost sorry not to get a chance to see the inevitable explosion. She wasn't at all sorry that she was not the one her boss was mad at. She'd risked her life plenty of times on the racetrack, but there were some things far more dangerous than that.
getting one of the richest men in the galaxy mad at you was one of them.
The Reverend Jordan Ayers, Rev to his friends and followers, wore a pensive look, somewhere between a sulk and a pout. A casual observer might have taken this to mean that something was bothering the chaplain of Omega Company, but no. The pout was merely his normal expression when he was calm or thoughtful. It was a direct and intentional result of the extensive facial remodeling that all devout members of the Church of the King underwent in order to more perfectly resemble their prophet. In any case, to someone meeting Rev for the first time, the pout was probably less off-putting than the sneer that his face assumed when he was actually in a cheerful frame of mind. Rev's initial success in converting the members of Omega Company to the Church of the New Revelation, or, as it was often known, the Church of the King, had been nothing short of phenomenal. But, as even he had to admit, recently the stream of converts had slowed to a trickle. For various doctrinal reasons, particularly the strong pressure for church members to have their face remodeled in the image of their prophet, Rev's denomination was somewhat lacking in appeal to the non-human sophonts among his larger flock, and even among the humans, a fair number were attached to some other denomination, while others were frankly uninterested in religion per se. While the company had been stationed on Lorelei or on Landor, this had not been of particular concern to Rev. In both localities, he had found plenty of potential converts in the indigenous human populations, but here on Zenobia, populated by a race of sentient Saurians, the king's message appeared to be falling on barren ground. Rev had turned to some of his favorite texts for inspiration. Elder Aaron's personal memoir, Any Place is Paradise, had reinforced Rev's belief that the king was present everywhere, and Bishop Scott E. Moore's Gonna Be Cool affirmed that true believers would survive even the heat death of the universe. But, as always, the deepest meanings came from the king's own words. Above all, the soulful admonition, "Don't be cruel." Rev's heart went flippity-flop every time he heard the king pronounce that sentiment. The words had lost absolutely none of their power as they'd come down the centuries. And yet, to his puzzlement, the Zenobian seemed deaf to all that. In fact, they seemed completely uninterested in anything the king had said or done. He drummed his fingers, staring out the window of the small office he occupied in the administrative wing of Omega Company's Zenobia headquarters module. Out on the parade ground, Flight Lieutenant Qual and two of his fellow Zenobians were making adjustments to some piece of equipment they'd brought along when they'd come to the Legion camp. The lizard-like sophons who had invited the Legion to this planet were every bit as intelligent as humans, or any of the other races that had become part of the Alliance. They showed as much imagination, as much curiosity about the universe they inhabited, as other species. Why, then, weren't they interested in the king's message? There was only one way to find out, Rev realized. He rose to his feet, with a sigh at the stiffness in his legs. Not for the first time, he reminded himself that he'd been neglecting his exercise program. There wasn't any excuse for that, not with a fully equipped gym right around the corner from his office, and the best instructors available, completely paid for by the Space Legion, or, more precisely, by Captain Jester. The king wouldn't have wanted one of his followers to let himself go, not when it was so easy to stay in shape. But at the moment, Rev was on a mission. He strode down the corridor to a convenient exit and came out onto the parade ground a short distance from where the Zenobians were working. He walked over to them, humming a favorite melodic pattern.
Dum-dum-ba-dum-dum, dum-ba-dum-dum.
Qual looked up at the chaplain's approach.
"Greetings, Crank,"
said the Zenobian officer, flashing his array of sharp reptilian teeth.
"Crank,"
said Rev, momentarily confused. Then he realized it must be another of the apparently random mistranslations the Zenobian's auto-translator spit out from time to time. Try as they might, the Legion's techs had never been able to adjust Qual's translator to render the name of Omega Company's commanding officer as anything but Captain Clown. A few members of the company privately suspected that Qual's mangling of human language was not entirely an artifact of his equipment, but they had never been able to prove anything, and since the little Zenobian was popular with the troops, nobody saw much point in making an issue of it. Remembering his purpose, Rev said,
"Good afternoon, Flight Lieutenant Qual. Do you have a moment to talk?"
"It's a long time since we converse," said Qual. "It would be my gratification."
Rev relaxed. He'd been worried that the Zenobian officer might be too involved in his work to answer his questions.
"You know, I have kind of a special job here," he began. "Sort of a mission, you might say."
"Yes, I have seen that," said Qual.
His two co-workers stood listening. Evidently, their officer's translator gave them the gist of what Rev was saying. Rev worried that what they heard might be a very distorted version of his actual words. But again, there was very little he could do about it.
"You are an officer, but one who gives advice, not orders," added the Zenobian.
"Yeah, that's the idea," said Rev. "Now, you must have heard me talk about the king."
"Many times, Crank," said Qual, still smiling. "You hardly speak of anything else."
"That's right," said Rev. "Now, what I want to know is, what do you all think about that? I mean, you people don't seem really interested in him."
"Oh, this king of yours is very interesting," said Qual,
and the other two Zenobians nodded eagerly. Rev smiled.
"Well, I didn't expect you to say that."
"But of course you cannot expect us to take him seriously," Qual added. "Humans ought to create their own myths instead of borrowing from more ancient species."
Rev scratched his head, puzzled.
"Borrowing? I don't understand."
The two Zenobian crew members opened their mouths in the posture Rev had come to recognize as laughter, but Qual kept a serious expression.
"Possibly you tell the truth, friend Crank," the Zenobian officer said. "I have noticed that you do not much understand the humor, but I have perhaps already said more than I should. We Zenobians do not lightly speak of our deepest racial beliefs, and I do not wish to expose our doctrines to you. I will tell you only that you need to convince one of our high shamans to tell you the tale of Leviz. It will be highly instructive, I can assure you. Now, if you will pardon me, I and my crew must complete our calibration of the Sklern. Good diurnal period, Crank."
The Rev stood there with his mouth open as Qual and his crew resumed their work, but after a moment he retreated, shaking his head. He hadn't learned everything he'd hoped he might, but what he had learned left him plenty of food for thought. Leviz, he'd remember that name, and when occasion arose, he'd follow up Qual's suggestion. There was a mystery here, and he meant to get to the bottom of it. Evening rush hour in Bootsy, the capital city of Kars Trio, was as hectic as rush hour in any other major city in human space. Try as they might, city planners had never figured out a way to eliminate the mass exodus of office workers into the transit system at the beginning and end of the business day. At some point or another, urban planners had tried any number of strategies to decentralize the business district, to stagger work hours, to facilitate telecommuting, none to any lasting effect. Centuries of complaints to the contrary. Neither the employers nor the workforce really wanted to change what had apparently become as fixed a pattern as the alternation of day and night. But while the dark-haired woman getting off the Bootsy slideway with two huge grocery bags at the Disco Loop was almost certainly unaware of the history behind her crowded ride home, she was by no means reconciled to it. She stalked up to the nondescript apartment building at the corner, elbowed her way into the grav shaft, and glared at her fellow denizens of the Disco Towers as they rose through the shaft together. There was an audible sigh of relief as she swung off on the fifth level and stomped down the hallway to her apartment door. She palmed the lock, bustled through the door, and headed for the kitchen. From the living room came the sound of a trivee set turned to a grav ball game. She ignored it and noisily dumped the bags on the kitchen table. From the other room came a male voice.
"Lola?"
She ignored that, too, muttering angrily as she began to unload the bags.
"Lola, you better come in here," said the voice, louder this time.
"Wait a minute," she barked. "Schmuck can't even come out and talk to me, let alone help," she thought darkly. "I ought to make him get his own meals."
"Lola, we got trouble," said the voice again.
"You're the one that's got trouble," she snapped,
turning to face the entrance to the living room. That's when she saw the stranger with a beamer pointed at her.
Who are you?"
she finished lamely. Unfortunately, she already had a very good idea what the answer had to be.
"I'm asking a question, sister," said the man, gesturing with the weapon. "You'll get in there with your buddy and don't try nothing fancy."
The way he handled the beamer was all the proof she needed that he knew what to do with it in the event something fancy did occur. She went into the living room. There sat Ernie, in a straight-back chair facing the tribee set. His arms were bound to his sides, and a wide band of elasteel around his torso bound him to the chair. On the couch next to him sat a small man in an expensive suit.
"Good. Everybody's here," said the small man. "Why don't you have a seat, Lola? We have business to discuss."
"Who are you?"
said Lola.
"We haven't done anything."
"That's exactly the problem," said the little man. "Sit down, please. It makes me uncomfortable to see you standing up."
He gestured toward the other chair in the room. Lola was not by nature docile, but something in the man's manner told her this would be a very bad time to make herself disagreeable. She sat.
"Good. That's very good," said the small man. "It makes things so unpleasant when people aren't in a cooperative mood. I really hate when we have to persuade people to go along with us."
"What do you want?" said Lola. "Who are you, anyway?"
The little man inspected his fingernails, then said,
"My name doesn't matter, but if you wish, you can call me Mr. V. My partner and I represent certain parties from whom you accepted an employment contract some time back. Perhaps you're familiar with the agreement I'm referring to."
Lola did her best to appear calm.
"This wouldn't have anything to do with Thorlai Station, would it?" she asked.
"Very good," said Mr. V, nodding enthusiastically. "It's always good to start from a position of mutual understanding. I was afraid that our little matter might have slipped your mind. May I inquire when we can expect you to fulfill your contractual obligations?"
"In fact, we made every effort to do exactly that," said Lola, twisting her neck to peer up at him. "There was an unexpected development."
"An unexpected development?"
The little man repeated her words sympathetically.
"That's the way things sometimes go in our business, isn't it? They never quite go the way you plan."
Lola nodded, smiling. Then Mr. V clapped his hands together loudly.
"But a professional doesn't let those little setbacks get in the way of completing the job. A professional knows how to overcome obstacles. You and your colleague are professionals, aren't you?"
"Of course we are," said Lola. "But—"
"But me no buts, young lady," said the little man, leaning forward to look her in the eyes. "You were engaged to deliver a certain package to a certain location. Now, it's been quite a long time, and the delivery has not taken place."
"I can explain that," said Lola.
Her mouth was suddenly dry.
"I am sure you can," said Mr. V. "But I'm going to save you the trouble, young lady. My principals aren't really interested in explanations, and neither am I. If we want explanations, there are any number of professional explainers whose services we can engage. At the moment, we would much rather see results. Do you grasp my meaning, young lady?"
"I think so,"
said Lola in a very quiet voice.
"Very good again," said the little man, turning away from her and pacing.
He stopped and turned and said,
"Now, to the point. Your contract calls for the delivery of certain goods. We are going to insist that you fulfill that contract, and we are furthermore going to insist that it be done without any further unnecessary delay. Do you understand me?"
Lola nodded.
"There may be additional expenses involved in retrieving the goods," she began.
Mr. V held up a finger, like a scolding schoolteacher.
"Young lady, I wouldn't be eager to ask for more money when I hadn't finished the job I'd contracted to do," he said. "Not if I were in your shoes. Certain people might get very impatient with you."
"I was merely pointing out the possibility," said Lola with a gulp. "It might not be a problem in any case. We can discuss that when everything's wrapped up."
"Good," said Mr. V, smiling again. "And I notice that you say when everything's wrapped up. Can I take that as meaning you intend to go ahead with your operation?"
"Yes, of course," said Lola. She smiled. "We never intended anything else."
"Good. It's a pleasure doing business," said Mr. V, rubbing his hands together. "I'll tell my principals that everything is in order then. And when can they expect delivery?"
Lola began calculating in her head. The big variable would be travel time. Hyperspace had unpredictable twists and wrinkles, and a ship might well arrive sometime before it had set out, or months later. Still, the expected travel time back to Lorelei ought to be something like 3 weeks.
"You want the package delivered to the same place as before?"
she asked.
"Precisely," said the little man with a nod.
60 days from now," said Lola. "That's cutting it close, but I think we can do that."
"We'll hold you to it," said Mr. V. "And just in case you're tempted to think about slipping out of your obligations again, I think we'll give you something else to think about."
He snapped his fingers, and the man with the beamer stepped into the room. Ernie's eyes grew wide.
Chapter 2
Journal Number 649.
The excesses of youth, as amusing as they may seem to those of riper experience, are nonetheless productive of worthwhile results. Youthful exuberance, wedded to the seemingly inexhaustible energies of the young, can achieve things that sober maturity would never attempt. It is undoubtedly for this reason that armies are made up of the young. The negative corollary of this verity is that, despite almost comically elaborate efforts to arrive at correct intelligence, armies are most easily duped than almost any other institution of similar size and complexity. And the same can be said of their individual members, only more so.
"Here's a package for you from Legion Headquarters, Captain," said Lieutenant Rembrandt, bustling into her commander's office.
"Oh, good. Maybe it's the promotion Ambassador Gottesman said I'm supposed to be getting," said Fool.
He took the package from her hands and eagerly began to tear it open.
"I never thought I'd make it to Major," he said. "I mean, I suppose I always hoped I'd do well in the Legion, maybe even make it to General. It's every officer's dream, I guess. But realistically, if you keep butting heads with the top brass, and I've pretty much made a full-time career of that."
He stopped suddenly, his face a snapshot of disappointment.
"What is it, sir?"
said Rembrandt.
"This isn't my promotion," said Fool. "It's a set of environmental impact forms from the Alliance Ecological Interplanetary Observation Union, the AEIOU.
"That's interesting," said Rembrandt. "Have we had any previous dealings with the AEIOU?
"Sometimes. Why?"
Fool asked his lieutenant.
"I just wondered what they wanted," said Rembrandt.
Fool looked at the cover letter.
"They want us to document our compliance with ecological preservation directives for undeveloped planets, and to submit our updated environmental preservation plan. There's a list of regulations."
"Undeveloped?"
Rembrandt frowned.
"Where do they get that? This is an inhabited world, last I looked. The desert out here may be fairly empty, but that Zenobian capital city you are in is about as developed as it gets."
"That was pretty much my impression," said Fool, scratching his head. "Somebody's gotten the wrong information."
"That could be a first-class pain," said Rembrandt. "You know these bureaucrats. Once they get the wrong idea, it's as good as gospel. I remember when the newspapers mixed up my Uncle Darrell with another guy who was killed in a skimmer accident. It took him nearly 16 years to convince the Planetary Employment Bureau that he was alive, and poor Uncle Darrell worked for them."
"Well, this is obviously irrelevant to a Legion mission," said Fool. "We've never had to file environmental impact forms before." "Don't bet on anything," said Tuscanini, who'd been sitting in one corner of the office, reading. "Environment all around us, so we having impact every day. Bureaucrats right to worry. I think is smart to fill out forms." "How about you do it, then?" said Fool, handing the pile of papers to the huge Voltron Legionnaire. "You fill out the paperwork, I'll sign it, and we'll send it back to the AEIOU. That'll get 'em off our back."
"I do it," said Tuscanini.
"When you want back?"
"I don't know. A week or so ought to be enough time," said Fool. "It's your baby now. You can use the spare desk in the comm center to work on it. Let me know if you run into any problems."
"We'll take good care of baby," said Tuscanini.
He tucked the papers under his arm and headed for the comm center. Rembrandt watched him go, a trace of worry on her face.
"Are you sure it's a good idea to give that job to him, Captain?" she said. "He's likely to come up with very strange answers to some of those questions. You know how his mind works. Sometimes I think he's too smart for his own good."
"Oh, I'm not worried about the AEIOU," said Fool. "You know what happens to paperwork. It just sits on some secretary's desk until they file it and forget it. Odds are no one will even glance at those forms, except to make sure we've filled them out and that I've signed them."
"I hope you're right," said Rembrandt. "There are enough people looking for ways to make trouble for you and for this company that I'd hate to see somebody else have an excuse to get on your case. It worries me that this came from Legion headquarters instead of directly from AEIOU.
"You don't need to worry," said Fool, waving his hand. "Remember, I'm the guy who handles problems from upstairs, and as long as Colonel Battleaxe and Ambassador Gottesman are on our side, we've got two people who can keep the trouble from ever getting as far as me. And I've got a pretty good idea how to keep them happy."
"I sure hope so, Captain," said Rembrandt.
She let her frown relax. Fool was probably right. Ever since he'd been on board, life with Omega Company had been steadily improving. Who was to say it wouldn't keep getting better and better? Three men met Victor Fool as he entered the casino offices. Two were dressed in well-tailored civilian garb,
the third in a black Space Legion officer's uniform. Only someone familiar with the minutiae of Legion uniforms would have noticed that the various patches and insignia he wore were completely bogus.
"All right, where's my son?" barked Victor Fool, ignoring the proffered handshake. "I've been trying to catch up with him for weeks, and every time I call, I either get some actor or a bunch of excuses. I want to see Willard, or talk to him directly if he's not on the station."
The elder of the two men in business suits answered him in a quiet but urgent voice.
"Mr. Fool, I'm Tully Bascom, head of gambling operations at the Fat Chance. I understand your concern, but I think this is a discussion that ought to take place in private," he said.
Fool glared at him, but after seeing the man's expression, he nodded.
"All right, then," he said. "This had better be good."
The man who'd spoken to him indicated a doorway to one side, through which a comfortably appointed small conference room was visible. At a nod from his boss, Fool's bodyguard stepped inside, quickly scanned the room, then nodded.
"Nothing obvious," he said.
"It's clean," said one of the men who'd greeted Fool. "Your son made sure of that. Come on in, Mr. Fool. Would you like coffee, tea, something else?"
"I'd like to talk to Willard," said Victor Fool, "and I've had about enough of your stalling. Where is he?"
"Off station," said Bascom. "And at last word, he was doing just fine. Come, sit down, Mr. Fool. I'll give you the full story, and if you insist, we can connect you to him. He's close enough so we can use regular intersystem comm."
Fool grumbled, but took a seat. Bascom introduced the others in the room. Gunther Raphael, Jr., former owner of the casino, and Doc, a veteran character actor Fool had hired to impersonate a Legionnaire in order to keep the crooked operators who ran Lorelei Station from learning that Omega Company had been transferred to another post, leaving the casino unguarded.
"This, isn't for general publication, you understand," said Bascom. "The captain is off station because he's decided that his military command takes priority over his other business. For the interim, he's left the place in our hands. And I don't mind telling you, Mr. Fool, if the captain walked in here unannounced 5 minutes from now, I don't think he'd find one thing that isn't being done exactly the way he'd do it himself."
"I'll be the judge of that, thank you," said Victor Fool, displaying no emotion. "From what I've seen so far, the boy hasn't entirely lost his head for business, but the devil is in the details, as you gentlemen know, and I'm going to withhold judgment until I've had a look at your books and your operations." "Can he do that?"
asked Gunther Raphael, turning to Bascom. He had a perpetually nervous look, as if he expected to be called on the carpet.
"Technically, probably not," said Bascom. He held up a hand to forestall Fool's protest. "But I'd be a damned fool if I didn't let him satisfy himself that the place is on a sound footing. Unless the captain explicitly forbids it, that is. Mr. Fool carries a lot of weight around here, but as far as I'm concerned, the captain carries more. No offense, Mr. Fool, but he's the man who put me in this job."
"I appreciate your loyalty to my son," said Victor Fool. "But loyalty only goes so far, Bascom. I've done business with the military long enough to know how much it values loyalty. That's all well and good, but where I disagree with it is when it elevates loyalty over competence. If a man can't do the job, I want another man in that job, before the first one costs me more money than his loyalty is worth. Do you understand me?"
"I understand you, Mr. Fool," said Bascom with a shrug. "Maybe I wouldn't be so quick to put a price on loyalty, but I agree with you on competence. I don't think I'm flattering myself to say that your son hired me because I've shown a fair bit of competence in the casino business. Now, would it be convenient for you to look over those books after lunch? While you're eating, on the house, of course. We can set up one of the executive offices for you to use."
"Bring me the books now," said Fool brusquely. "I want to see both sets, the real ones and the phony ones you use for the tax auditors, and I'll work at the desk my son uses when he's here. I don't expect there's anybody else who needs that particular space."
"I'll need you to, excuse me a minute for that," said Bascom, standing up. "I'll send in a waiter to take your drink order."
"Forget the waiter," snapped Fool. "Just bring me the books, and it better not be too long."
"It takes as long as it takes," growled Bascom.
He turned on his heel and marched out of the room. 20 minutes later, Bascom returned with a determined expression on his face. Without saying a word, he unlocked a file drawer, removed a pair of memory modules, and handed them to Victor Fool.
"These have both sets of books on them," he said.
I guess you'll want to use your own computer, but we can give you one to use if you like.
I'll let you know, said the elder fool brusquely. Now, have that imposter clear off the desk and get out of my way. I want to get to work.
All right, Smarty. So what's the plan now? Ernie grumbled.
Their unwanted visitors had left, but he'd had to wait until Lola managed to find a tool strong enough to cut the plasteel tape Mr. V's muscle man had used to confine him before he could get out of the chair they'd put him in. He still had sticky patches on his arms from where the tape had held them. Touching them made him shudder. He didn't even want to think about what might have happened. She shrugged.
We go back to Lorelei, of course, she said. That's our only choice.
And when we get there? She shrugged again.
I'll figure something out.
You'll figure something out? Ernie's voice rose an octave. You bet you will. You're the one who got us in this fucking mess to begin with.
I seem to remember you agreeing to take the job way back when it was first offered, said Lola. In fact, you were pretty gung-ho about it.
Ernie scoffed.
Yeah, that's before we tried snatching that damn robot, which had us both fooled into thinking it was fool. Then, when we tried to smuggle it off-planet, it manages to steal a lifeboat off a space liner and bail out right in the middle of hyperspace. I don't think I'll ever figure that one out. We might as well forget about snatching that punk.
Good idea, said Lola, except that Mr. V and his clients aren't going to let us forget it. At least, not until we show them enough of an effort to convince them we're playing the game their way. If there's some way for us to bail out when things get sticky, I'll find it. Don't you worry.
Ernie's eyes bulged out.
Don't me worry, he growled. Next time, see how you like sitting there with 10 yards of plasteel tape holding you to the chair and an ugly guy with a beamer aimed up your nostrils. I've been there, and I don't like it worth an unplugged vert.
Oh, come on, said Lola, grinning mischievously. You look really cute when you're helpless, you know.
Gee, thanks, said Ernie.
He thought a moment, frowning, before he continued.
Does this mean...
Forget about it, said Lola, in a tone that left no room for doubt. Right now, my main priority is keeping my skin intact, which means getting a ticket on the next spaceliner headed back to Lorelei.
That's gonna cost us an arm and a leg, grumbled Ernie.
Lola fixed him with an exasperated stare.
And what do you think it'll cost us not to go back?
I know, said Ernie. We gotta look as if we're gonna try to finish the job. But what if we can't anyway? We'll be out all that money and running for our lives to boot. If we're gonna spend the rest of our lives running, what's the point in blowing all our money right from the get-go? Worse, what's the point of spending it to get someplace where the guys who are trying to do us in are running the show?
If they were really running the show on Lorelei, they wouldn't have to bring us in to snatch Fool, said Lola. Hey, they might even have figured out that Fool's got a robot there to impersonate him. That little fact could be worth a nice bundle all by itself.
Ernie frowned again.
Why did you think of that when those bastards were getting ready to wake me over?
It wasn't the right time to play that card, said Lola calmly. Those guys didn't come here looking for information, so why should we give it to them? We have to hang on until we can trade it for something we want.
Yeah, huh? Said Ernie. Next time the big guys have you tied up with plasteel, ready to slice and dice and barbecue, I can guarantee you, you'll have a damn good idea what you want.
Ernie, Ernie,
said Lola, shaking her head.
I got us out of that little fix, didn't I? If we keep obsessing about every little setback, we'll never make any progress toward our long-range goals. You understand that, don't you?
My longest-range goal is to keep on breeding, said Ernie. It ain't such a bad idea to avoid unnecessary pain, either. Come to think of it, there's no such thing as necessary pain in my book.
Well, we'll do what we can to avoid pain, said Lola. But the best way to ensure that right about now is to get ourselves on a starship headed for Lorelei. So give me your credit chip and I'll get busy on that, and once we're on the way, we'll have plenty of time to work out the next steps.
All right, said Ernie, reaching for his wallet. But this better be good.
Don't worry, said Lola brightly. I expect everything to work out perfectly this time.
Her smile as she took his credit chip was almost sincere enough to convince him. Sergeant Mayhem's eyes bulged out in disbelief. He'd been assigned as the Space Legion recruiting officer on Talloon for close to 15 years,
Ever since he'd managed to pyramid a minor injury sustained during the Stoddard's World Police action into a cushy desk job far from any chance of action, little had he realized just how far he was going to be from the action. In his entire time on Talun, he'd averaged less than one recruit a year, on a planet with a population pushing the 3 billion mark. He still didn't understand how the Legion could afford to keep him here. Probably some clerk had figured out that letting him retire, paying his pension, a hefty sum considering his years in service, giving him passage to a world of his choice, and shipping a replacement out to Talun would cost the Legion more than keeping him on the rolls. Assuming they were ever going to replace him, given the results over the years, it hardly seemed worth the Legion's while. But sure enough, here sat one of the planet's natives on the other side of his desk, practically begging to enlist. It took all his willpower to keep from drooling at the prospect.
"Well, Sonny, do you think you have what it takes to be a Legionnaire?" he asked.
The question blithely skimmed over the fact that all it really took to be a Legionnaire was the ability to walk, stumble, or crawl into a recruiting station and do something, almost anything, that could reasonably be interpreted as an effort to enlist. The Legion was far from picky.
"I honestly don't know, sir," said the native. "All I can say is that I've been doing everything I possibly can to prepare myself. I've got excellent grades in school."
"Very good,"
said Sergeant Mayhem, nodding enthusiastically. He himself had left school as early as the law on his home planet allowed, at roughly age 14, if he remembered correctly. It had been a good while back. His lack of education hadn't hampered his Legion career, as far as he could tell. How smart did a guy have to be to carry a gun and dig ditches?
"And I think I'm in excellent physical condition," the native continued. "I've played 3 varsity sports, and I've got 3 belts and 2 different martial arts."
"Great," said Mayhem.
That made it slightly more likely that the recruit would complete basic Legion training, which he needed to do if the recruiting officer was going to get his bonus for bringing in a live one. Mayhem had lost the bonus on about a third of his recruits. He always hated when that happened, but this one sounded as if he might actually make it through the not-too-rigorous Legion boot camp, as long as he didn't mind being treated like dirt.
"You have any idea what you're getting yourself in for?"
he asked, somewhat reluctantly. He certainly didn't want to scare the kid off, but the regulations required him to make it more or less clear that this wasn't going to be any kind of picnic.
"The Legion's not for softies, you know," he continued. "If the Alliance winds up in a war, it's the Legion that's going to get sent to fight it. You understand what that means, don't you?"
"I understand, sir, and I'm ready," said the native. "What do I have to do to join?"
"Read this paper and sign it," said Mayhem. "You'll take a copy home and think about it for 24 hours. If you haven't changed your mind by tomorrow, you're in."
"Yes, sir," said the native.
He practically bounced over the desk to grab the stylus out of Mayhem's hands and quickly put his signature on the enlistment form, then handed the top copy back to the sergeant.
"Zigger," said Mayhem, looking at the form. "Well, you'll want to choose a Legion name before you report for training. You might start thinking about what name you want."
"Oh, I've thought about it a long time," said Zigger. "I've already made up my mind."
"Don't tell me," said Mayhem. "Once you join, nobody should know your civilian name. The pay computer will keep your record so everything is in order. But I can tell you for a fact that nobody in the Legion will look into it during your actual term of service. That way, you'll be judged by what you do in the Legion uniform, not what you've done before or who your parents were."
The latter was a polite fiction. In fact, a lot of Legion officers were where they were because of who their parents were and how much they'd been willing to spend to put them in an officer's uniform. But there was no point in telling this kid the hard facts of life. He'd figure them out soon enough, probably at the hand of a snotty junior officer who'd spent most of his life ordering servants around and considered enlisted Legionnaires one more variety of servant. Mayhem didn't particularly care. As long as he'd cashed the recruitment bonus well before the kid learned what a rotten deal he'd signed up for. Whatever happened to the kid after that was the kid's own lookout. Mayhem grinned just thinking about the bonus, and the kid grinned back.
"Sucker," thought Mayhem. "I wish I had 1 million more like you. But you'll do. You'll do just fine for now."
"Hello, sweetie,"
came Mother's insinuating voice over the intercom in Fool's office.
"That cute Ambassador Goddessman is on the line asking for you."
"Great, put him through," said Fool.
He wondered what the Alliance's ambassador was calling about this time. By now,
Fool and his Legion Company had established themselves as firm favorites with the diplomatic branch. Their successful peacekeeping mission on Landor, then their performance in the delicate position of establishing the first Alliance presence on Zenobia, had given State two comparatively easy victories in situations where a good deal had been at stake. But it was too soon for the authorities to be considering a new mission for the Omega Mob, and it was as sure a bet as anything in the galaxy that Gottesman was not spending State's money on an interstellar voice call just to chat up his old friend. Something interesting was undoubtedly on deck. The light on Fool's desk came on, then the ambassador's voice came through.
"Hello, Captain Jester. I hope all's well out your way," said the ambassador.
"Coming along very smoothly, sir," said Fool. "The Zenobians have pretty much accepted us as the logical go-betweens in their attempts to establish relations with the Nanoids, and our talks with the Nanoids have progressed to the point where we can begin to address substantive issues."
"Good, good," said the ambassador. "State's hoping to get a xenological team there to handle these negotiations on a more professional basis, but until one of the two native parties makes a formal request, we can't very well stick our nose in. Have you seen any sign that either side is likely to make such a request?"
"Nothing so far, sir," said Fool. "But the Zenobians are still not convinced that the Nanoids aren't off-planet intruders, and to be honest with you, we can't prove that either. We're moving along as best we can, but I can't say there's any sign of a major breakthrough yet."
"Well, if you're doing your best, that's likely to be as good a job as anyone can do," said Gottesman. "We'll just have to bide our time. Goo knows we're used to that in the diplomatic branch. But here's something you can do for us in the meantime, Captain. I understand Zenobia is pretty much an untamed world out beyond the natives' urban centers."
"I suppose so," said Fool. "Out where we are is certainly wild enough. What do you have in mind, sir?"
The ambassador cleared his throat and said,
"Well, as it happens, we've got a number of civilians who've done the government a few, favors over the years, if you know what I mean. And it so happens that some of them have gotten the idea that there might be some fairly large game running loose on Zenobia, something on the order of the larger dinosaurs. Am I right about that, Captain?"
"Well, there are some fairly large specimens here, if what I saw in the zoo back in the capital city is any indication," said Fool. "I can't say I've seen any such in the wild, though. We're out here in the desert, you know, and most of the animals I've seen out here are fairly small, although a few of them are pretty nasty. But most of the larger creatures on this world seem to be swamp dwellers. Anyway, the natives don't really seem to want us trampling through their swamps. I get the idea those are prime recreation areas, from their point of view."
"I see," said the ambassador. "Well, I may ask you to talk to some of their people to see if we can get some, exceptions made. There are a couple of VIPs who've taken a fancy to do some serious big game hunting, and they have gotten the notion that some of the beasties there on Zenobia are about as big as they come. Have you heard anything about an animal the natives call a griff?"
"Not much more than the name," admitted Fool.
"From what the natives say, I'd guess it's a big, slow-moving, and rather stupid herbivore. Not very exciting to hunt, I'd imagine."
"Nothing's very exciting to hunt, as far as I'm concerned," said the ambassador. "Much more civilized to play tetra-go in a comfortable chair with a cold drink close to hand. But there's no accounting for tastes. I get the impression that if it's big enough, that's all the justification some of these fellows need. How much trouble do you think it'd be to get the Zenobians' permission for a party of off-worlders to come in and bag a few trophies?"
"All I can promise is to give it a try," said Fool dubiously. "Give me a couple of days and I'll get back to you if I can convince them."
"Great. I knew I could count on you," said Ambassador Gottesman. "And remember, you can always call on me if you need anything that State can help with. Gotta run." And he closed the connection.
"Well, the Zenobians aren't going to like this one bit," said Fool, looking across the office at Beaker, who had sat there silently during the call. "I can imagine Chief Potentary Korg's face when I run this idea past him."
"Something like this was inevitable, sir," said the butler. "The State Department didn't support you for this assignment out of altruism, you know. It was just a matter of time before the quid pro quo became obvious."
"Well, Gottesman has taken our side against the General more than once," said Fool. "I can't refuse him something in return. It's only fair."
Beaker sniffed.
"There's nothing fair about it," he said. "In fact, it has a distinct odor."
"So we'll hold our noses and do what we can," said Fool, with a resigned tone. "If the Zenobians say no,
that'll be an end to it.
I doubt it, sir, said Beaker. But Fool wasn't listening.
Chapter 3 Journal Number 653
The job description of a junior Legion officer